cultivated in the palace greenhouse. How else could they have roses in April? The cutlery was heavy silver, although Alexandra apologized that they were not using the best plate, and that the meal was very plain. Dmitri thought it not at all plain, with a cream soup, followed by fish fillets in a light-as-air sauce, mutton in gravy, and then a dainty dish of apple compote. The girls led the conversation, alternately teasing each other, asking Dmitri whether he had seen any wild bison or bears at the front. He had, but only from a distance, and discussing patients in the hospital. Tatiana seemed reserved in their company, often stepping in to broker peace between her two younger sisters, and Alexandra seemed distracted, scarcely talking at all. After the meal, Dmitri was surprised when Alexandra asked if he would join her for tea in the adjoining portrait hall. He immediately rose to his feet and followed her, with just a glance of farewell to Tatiana. What did she want to talk about? How much did she know about his relationship with her second oldest daughter? Might she be about to ask him his intentions towards her, and if so, what would he reply? The portrait hall was vast and airy, with burnished gold pillars, a slippery parquet floor, and the most exquisite chandelier Dmitri had ever seen, with cascades of what looked like millions of tiny crystals. Alexandra sat on a settee under a huge portrait of Catherine the Great, and he took a chair nearby as a waiter poured steaming cups of tea from a heavy silver samovar and set a little bowl of chocolates between them. Dmitri was tempted to take a sweet because they looked scrumptious, but Alexandra didn't, so he felt it might not be correct etiquette. On a side table, there was a display of the elaborate Fabergé eggs the family gave one another for Easter, each worth thousands of rubles. Tatiana had told him the family had stopped buying new clothes with the outbreak of war and were having to patch and mend old garments, but the Tsarina looked very grand in a chocolate-brown gown with embroidery of bronze foliage. She wore four strings of pearls around her neck, a diamond-encrusted star of the Order of St. Alexander Nevsky on her breast, and a huge aquamarine ring on her finger.
"Tell me, when you left the front line, had any of the mobile field guns arrived?"
Alexandra began. Her manner was austere, but not unfriendly.
"Yes, they had, but the men have not had much practice in firing them," he replied. "Is it difficult to fire them?"
"The machines are heavy. One man in my company was seriously injured by the backwards thrust of a..." He hesitated, struggling to think of the English word for a shell casing. Alexandra nodded to indicate she understood.
"Do you think they will make a difference?"
she asked.
"You may speak freely. I know there are some successes in Galicia, but we seem to have reached a stalemate to the north of the line. What do you think it will take to push the invader back behind their own borders again?"
Dmitri noted the term she used, the invader. These were her own people by birth. What an awkward situation she found herself in. He told her his opinion, that there was no point in pushing forwards at one point in the line only. As they had discovered early in the war, the German troops were quick to cut off and encircle advance parties, with catastrophic consequence. "I believe we should not mount another attack until the whole line from north to south has the new weapons and the men are ready to use them in one concerted push." She nodded, as if he had confirmed her own views.
"Tell me, are supplies reaching the men? Were they adequately fed in your part of the line?"
Dmitri hesitated.
"There were supply problems during our retreat, but now that we are static, the situation has improved."
He could still smell the garlic scent, which seemed to emanate from her pores rather than her breath. After 10 minutes of war talk, she announced abruptly that she must retire to rest before her afternoon's duties, and Dmitri leapt to his feet and bowed as she walked out. At the doorway she turned and regarded him with a friendly smile.
"Please take those chocolates with you, Cornet Malama. They are too sweet for my tooth."
"Thank you, Your Imperial Highness." His face was scarlet as he bowed again. Had she noticed him eyeing them? All the same, he decided to accept her offer, so he scooped up the contents of the bowl before the butler showed him to the door. Walking back to the stables, rich chocolate melting on his tongue, he mused over what had passed. Had he been invited solely so that Alexandra could pick his brains about the war? What had she thought of him? Should he have been less frank, more obsequious? He got his answer that evening when Tatiana rushed into the stables in her uniform, fresh from her evening lesson with Vera Gedroitz.
"My darling, you have charmed the entire family. I knew you would. Mama wrote to Papa this afternoon telling him she thought you would make an admirable son-in-law. Can you believe it? I've been so excited, I couldn't wait to tell you."
She was bouncing up and down like a gleeful child. Dmitri blanched.
"She wrote that? Does it mean... do you think she might let us marry soon?"
"Oh, mon chéri."
She cocked her head.
"Not during wartime. We wouldn't be able to make suitable arrangements, and our wedding must be a state occasion. Besides, my sister Olga should be allowed to marry first. I will urge her to hurry and choose her husband. She has too many favourites and must try to narrow it down to one."
"Can we at least announce our engagement?" Dmitri asked. "Many have guessed we are close, and I would not like to compromise your reputation."
"I will ask Mama, but I get the impression she wants it to be an unofficial engagement for now. It's good for us to have this time in which our love is secret, so we can get to know each other better without the eyes of the world watching."
She glanced at the door.
"I can't stay now, as I must get back to sterilization duties. I simply couldn't wait to tell you the news."
They embraced quickly, and Dmitri inhaled the scent of her hair. It made him remember something from earlier. "What is that strange perfume your mother wears? I didn't recognize it." Tatiana glanced round to check no one was listening, then wrinkled her nose.
"She smells peculiar, doesn't she? I give her daily arsenic injections for exhaustion, and it appears to cause that odor. Olga has it too. Didn't you notice? I'll see you tomorrow, dearest. By the side gate at 2:30.
They slipped into the habit of spending an hour together each afternoon. In fair weather, they took Autopo for a walk round the park, trying in vain to teach her to fetch a ball, or rode out on horseback. On rainy days they played card games, read poetry to each other, or simply sat conversing. They never ran out of conversation, and Dmitri saved things to tell her. Snippets of conversation he'd overheard, or amusing anecdotes about the horses, sometimes a joke. Usually there would be a lady's maid somewhere in the background, acting as chaperone, but she tactfully kept her distance, and it was easy to feel as though they were alone. One morning, Dmitri turned a corner in the park and overheard some guards gossiping about the elder Romanov girls. He should have stopped them straight away, but instead he paused to listen.
"They've both got favourites amongst the men, I hear. Olga is completely smitten with that Mitya, and Tatiana's in love with Volodya."
The pain in Dmitri's heart was like a stab wound.
Who was Volodya, and what was he to Tatiana?
He rushed to the guardroom and made inquiries, learning that he was a second lieutenant in the 3rd Guards Rifles Regiment, who had spent several weeks in hospital the previous autumn. He was a friend of Olga's sweetheart Mitya, and had a reputation as a lady killer. It seemed the four of them had sometimes played croquet together, before Volodya had been cured and sent back to the front the previous Christmas. Just as well for him, Dmitri thought grimly. He was consumed with such raging jealousy that had the man still been in town, he would have been tempted to seek him out and beat him to within an inch of his life. Chapter 13. At the beginning of May 1916, just over a month after Dmitri's return, the Romanovs, including Tsar Nicholas, went on holiday to Crimea. It was their first trip since 1913, and Dmitri knew how much Tatiana loved it there. But watching their Delaunay Belleville automobile disappear down the road towards the station made him feel ill. His limbs were heavy, his brow fevered, and his head aching. How would he last 3 weeks without her? She had promised to write, but letters were no longer enough to satisfy him. He only felt truly alive when in her presence.
"I am so terribly glad to see the sea," Tatiana wrote. "Olga and I have been lying in the sun, so I hope you will not mind your fiancé's face being brown as a nut. The warmth appears to be helping Mama's health, and little Alexei is quite animated, badgering the sailors to tell him stories about German U-boats. We sailed from Odessa to Sevastopol, but do not have time to travel to Levadia, as Father and Alexei must soon return to the front."
Dmitri read her letter with a sour feeling in his stomach. How could she enjoy herself when he was bereft without her? And then he rebuked himself. What kind of lover would resent his loved one's happiness? Was love always so selfish? He should be pleased for her, and he tried, but he was out of sorts and moody with the staff in the stables and didn't regain his cheerful spirits until her return. Tatiana's 19th birthday fell on the 29th of May, and Dmitri bought her a pair of amethyst drop earrings, which he thought would bring out the violet in her eyes. They were well beyond his means on army pay, and would involve repaying his debt to the jeweller monthly for over a year, but it was worth it to see Tatiana's delight with the gift. She hugged him and kissed his cheek before threading them through her earlobes and seeking a mirror to check her reflection.
"I have far less jewellery than you might suppose."
She turned her head one way and another, admiring the effect.
"Mama used to give us each a single pearl on our birthdays, so that by our 16th we would have enough for a pearl necklace. But I have few pairs of earrings, and certainly no amethysts. I do believe this is my favourite stone."
"Will you celebrate with your family later?" Dmitri asked, smiling at her girlish excitement and delighted by the apparent success of his gift.
"Just my sisters. Papa and Alexei are at Stavka."
She hesitated.
"I believe Mama has asked Rasputin to stop by."
Dmitri glowered.
"On your birthday? Is he so close to the family?"
Tatiana pursed her lips.
"Yes, he is. I must introduce you so you can see he is nothing like the image you have. He's a very sweet, gentle man."
Dmitri snorted. "Even if he is a good man, and all the stories I have heard are wrong, the fact remains that the Russian people mistrust him. They blame his influence for all that is wrong with the country, for the food shortages, for the lack of progress in defeating Germany, for the railway strikes. He boasts of his power over your mother, saying he can make her do anything."
"I didn't know there were food shortages and railway strikes."
Tatiana frowned.
"But how could these be Rasputin's fault? He is a holy man, a healer."
"Of course they are not his fault directly, but people think they are, and that's what matters. Your mother would do well to ban him from the palace while she is running the country's affairs. Perhaps he should go back to Siberia, at least till after the war." He worried about speaking so frankly to Tatiana, who looked upset and bewildered, but it felt as though he had a duty to do so when he might one day be a member of the family.
"There's something I must explain," she said quietly. "Come, sit down."
They were in the grounds of the Catherine Palace, and she led him to a bench with a view over the chain of waterfalls that gushed into the great pond. He waited as she chose her words.
"It's a family secret, but as you are to be one of us, I think it is time you were told. You know that Alexei has frail health."
Dmitri frowned. Everyone knew that. Tatiana bit her lip.
"I am worried that you might change your mind about marrying me if I tell you the rest."
Dmitri grabbed her hand and squeezed it tightly. "Whatever the secret, I promise I will not change my mind." She nodded, as if she had known this would be the case, then continued.
"Alexei suffers from the bleeding disorder known as haemophilia that also afflicts some of my cousins in Prussia."
Dmitri gave a sharp intake of breath, and Tatiana continued.
"When he bumps his leg, even mildly, it can mean bleeding into his joints, and he has almost died several times in his short life. Back in 1912, after he injured himself jumping onto a boat, he was so poorly that he was given the last sacrament. But every time, Uncle Grigori manages to heal him where the doctors have failed. He has brought Alexei back from the edge of the grave many times. This is why the family cannot be without him. But of course we can never explain this to the Russian people, because Alexei is the male heir who must carry on the Romanov line."
Dmitri could see the problem. They could not admit to such fragility in the succession.
"I'm so sorry, Angel. It must be a terrible worry for you all."
Suddenly Alexandra's reliance on the wild man and Nicholas's forbearance of him made sense.
"It is something you must consider," Tatiana told him. "Were we to have a son, there is a chance of him inheriting this vile disease because it is passed through the female line. That's why it is only fair to warn you now in case you wish to reconsider your proposal.
Dmitri was aghast. Did she know him so little? He fell to his knees on the path in front of her, his voice shaking with emotion.
There is nothing that would make me reconsider. Nothing. Now I know the truth about your brother. I love you more than ever.
You are so pure and unselfish,
she marveled, placing her hand on his shoulder. He felt unworthy, remembering his recent burst of selfishness when she went on holiday. Sometimes his love felt like a kind of uncontrollable madness, but he was proud beyond measure that she had shared with him the very sensitive family secret. The trust between them had grown daily that spring. She had often confided in him when her sisters annoyed her, or when her mother's illnesses were hard to bear, but to share this particular confidence meant she considered him one of the family, and he was deeply honored. After Tatiana went back to work, Dmitri pondered what she had said. If Alexei proved too frail to produce an heir, how would it affect the succession to the throne? Would Nicholas be succeeded by Olga and her husband, followed by their children? And what if Olga failed to marry, like his sister Valerina? Would the succession pass to Tatiana and himself? He did not want to be Tsar. The desire to rule was not in his nature. His deepest wish was that one day he and Tatiana would have a home in the countryside where they could keep horses and dogs and have children of their own, God willing. If one of their sons inherited the bleeding disorder, they would deal with it in due course. He felt as though it was tempting fate to think so far ahead. What if the war continued to go badly for Russia? How many years might it be until they could marry? What if she fell for someone else before then? Was there a possibility that Tatiana could be forced into an arranged marriage as part of a peace treaty? He tortured himself with these imagined scenarios, and only relaxed during his afternoons with Tatiana, when he felt the sureness of her love calming him. The weather in St. Petersburg that June was magnificent. Warm and cloudless, with just an occasional overnight shower to freshen the flower displays that bloomed profusely across the royal estates in both formal and informal gardens. At last, the news from the front was encouraging. General Brusilov's offensive had forced the Austro-Hungarian army to retreat, and by the end of the month they had advanced 60 miles and taken 350,000 prisoners. It proved what the mighty Russian army could do when they had a decent leader at the helm, and gave them all succor. However, the picture changed in July, when German troops were diverted from the Western Front to fight back, and Russian casualties once more began to mount. On the 27th of August, Romania decided to declare war on Austro-Hungary, and as a result, Brusilov had hundreds more miles of front line to defend, right down into the Balkans. Suddenly, there were whispers in the guardroom that all able-bodied men were to be called back to the front, and Dmitri prayed fervently he would not be among them. One evening in early September, he heard that a new influx of wounded officers had arrived at the Catherine Palace, and among them was the man named Volodya, with whom Tatiana was rumoured to have formed an attachment in his absence. He had suffered a spinal injury, Dmitri heard, and could be there for some time. Jealousy gnawed his insides like a hungry rodent. He had never asked Tatiana about Volodya, partly because he was too proud, but also because he feared that some tiny passing expression would give away the truth that she'd had feelings for him, and he couldn't bear that. He considered visiting the hospital to catch sight of his rival, but couldn't face the anguish if he walked in and found Tatiana chatting to him, smiling at him. Then, as cruel fate would have it, the morning after Volodya's arrival, a letter came with fresh orders for Dmitri. He was to report to a post in Moldova by the 20th of September. He slumped to the ground, his heart beating rapidly. How could he leave Tsarsko Selo when his rival was there and Tatiana would see him every day? Dmitri sat breathing hard, all kinds of crazy plans flashing through his mind. He would sneak into the ward by night and hold a pillow over Volodya's face. He would ask Tatiana to elope with him, and they would run off together to a country that was not involved in this bloody war. And then came an idea that was not quite so far-fetched. There was only one way he could return to the front with any kind of equanimity. It had to be worth a try. Chapter 14. Dmitri told Tatiana of his orders while they sat in the wildflower meadow just beyond the Lama House in the grounds of the Alexander Palace. She had woven a garland of chamomile flowers and placed it around his neck, where it hung over his uniform, the white petals already drooping. Immediately she burst into tears.
"Oh, my Lama, I can't bear it. How shall I live without you?"
She clutched his arm, distraught.
"You have no idea how scared I was when you were at the front line before. I woke every morning with a lump in my throat, as if a stone were lodged there. And now we are so much closer, it will be unbearable."
Her shoulders shook with sobbing.
"Hush, angel."
He put an arm around her, close to tears himself. Tatiana brought out a softness in him that he was not familiar with. She continued,
"At least with Papa and Alexei, I know they will be kept out of danger. But you are the type who rushes out in the face of enemy fire. I can't lose you, Dmitri, I simply can't."
He kissed her hair, his insides melting at her anguish. Then he leaned over so his forehead rested against hers. "Can you read my thoughts?" he asked. She shook her head, and a silky strand of hair tickled his cheek. "I have faced death many times during this war," he told her quietly, seriously, "but never when I had so much to lose. The strength of our love has grown so vast these past months that I find myself unable to risk losing you."
"You will never lose me," she replied huskily.
He breathed hard, his forehead still resting on hers, and continued, "I'm going mad, Tatiana. I feel like banging my head against a wall with frustration that I must wait till this infernal war is over to marry you, and that I might die without ever knowing that sweet joy. The only thing that would make this parting bearable would be if you would marry me before I go." She drew a quick, surprised breath, and he spoke hurriedly. "I know we can't have an official state wedding, but why not a secret ceremony, just for us? I'm not asking that we lie together, much as the idea thrills me. I only want us to be united in God's eyes, so that if my time is up, I will go to heaven knowing that you truly love me, and that you will one day join me for all eternity." Tears pooled in her eyes.
"I couldn't bear for you to die. Please, don't talk that way. Being married to you, I would have everything to live for. I would know for sure you'd be waiting for me on my return, and that I could trust your love to be as strong as ever. I promise you, Tatiana, that if you do this for me, I will ensure I survive."
She leaned her head back to look him in the eyes.
"But who would perform such a ceremony?"
"A friend of mine, Father Oblonsky. He is a priest from my hometown. I have already asked if he would be willing to conduct a secret ceremony between me and the girl I love, and he has agreed. His chapel is a few miles down the Kuzminka River. We could go there by night to avoid being seen. No one need know." He waited for her to drink this in, grateful that at least she hadn't ruled it out straight away.
"But if we then married formally after the war, would it not be bigamous?"
"Father Oblonsky says not." He had only half listened to the old priest's explanation about how it could work, overjoyed to hear that he was prepared to conduct a ceremony. He watched as love and duty wrestled in Tatiana's mind.
"My parents must never find out, and you must promise with all your heart that you will not make me a widow."
Her eyes were sad, but she had a determined air. It was only then Dmitri realized with a start that she must love him almost as much as he loved her, otherwise she would not take such a risk. "I promise." He touched her eyelashes with the tip of a finger to brush away a tear caught there. 3 nights later, they met at a side entrance of the Alexander Palace at midnight. Dmitri led 2 horses, and they jumped on horseback and rowed to the riverbank, where he had moored a rowing boat. He lit a candle for Tatiana to hold as he rowed downstream, and her eyes were wide in the flickering light. Neither spoke, each lost in their own thoughts, with the lapping of the water against the edge of the boat and the hoot of an owl the only sounds.
"Are you sure about this, angel?"
Dmitri asked, as he helped her ashore at a little mooring.
"I'm sure."
The door of the chapel was open, and Father Oblonsky was waiting in his vestments of rich red and gold pattern, with a gold mitre on his head, and a heavy gold cross around his neck. He ushered them in, quickly blessed the rings Dmitri handed over, then began the age-old rituals to bind them for life. They were each given a candle to hold. Tatiana's hand was trembling, and she looked dazed, but incredibly beautiful in her chaste white gown with throat-hugging neckline. The sweet fog of incense rising from the censers, the priest's deep lilting voice, the glittering gold icons of the chapel interior, made it seem like a dream.
Eternal God, that joinest together in love them that were separate, who hast ordained the union of holy wedlock that cannot be set asunder.
They followed instructions as the priest asked Dmitri to put his larger ring on Tatiana's finger, then her smaller one on his own little finger, and sign them with the cross.
O Lord, our God, who hast poured down the blessings of thy truth according to thy holy covenant upon thy chosen servants, our fathers, from generation to generation, bless thy servants Dmitri and Tatiana, and make their troth fast in faith, and union of hearts, and truth, and love.
This was the moment at which they officially became man and wife, and they caught eyes shyly. Tatiana smiled, but Dmitri was too overawed to react. His ears were buzzing, his legs like jelly, his brain on fire. It was the most precious moment of his life, and yet he felt he was barely conscious. He wanted time to slow down so he could savor each second, analyze each word of the service, live this moment to the full. They both took sips from the proffered cup of rich altar wine, then the priest wrapped his stole around their joined hands to unite them till kingdom come. All too soon it was over, and they embraced, letting their lips graze the others, the most delicious sensation Dmitri had ever experienced.
May God bless you and keep you safe for the rest of your lives, Father Oblonsky said in farewell. I wish you all the happiness in the world.
They did not have time to linger, as it was already 3 in the morning. Back on the river, Dmitri had to strain to row against the current. Black trees waved their branches against the moonlit sky. Tatiana was silent, and he wondered what she was thinking. Even at this moment, when they should be closer than any two people in the world, he was frustrated by the ultimate unknowability of another person. Was she regretting their actions? Did she feel he had forced her into it? "Are you all right?" he asked tentatively. She sighed, sounding blissfully happy.
"I am going over the priest's prayers in my head. I never want to forget a single detail of this night. No grand state wedding could ever compare to the beautiful simplicity of the promises we have made."
A sob escaped from Dmitri's throat, and he lifted an oar from the water so he could wipe his eye with his sleeve. His father used to chide him for crying, saying he was like a silly chit of a girl who needed to learn to control his emotions. A few moments later, a bend in the river brought his face into the moonlight, and he knew Tatiana would see that his cheeks were glistening with tears. But he also knew it didn't matter, because she would understand.
Chapter 15. Lake Akanabi, New York State, end of July 2016. Kitty threw herself into work on the cabin with a passion. First she used her chainsaw to hack down the branches overhanging the track so she could drive along it. That was vital, so she could transport planks of wood and panes of glass for her repairs, as well as take away all the rubbish and the old bed to a dump. She climbed onto the cabin roof and mended a rusted patch, then pushed her broom down the chimney to clear the abandoned birds' nests inside. She cut down the sapling that had grown up through the porch steps, chopping it into lengths for firewood. She painstakingly rebuilt the steps, planing, sanding, and weatherproofing the wood, then adding curved banisters on either side. In her head was her father's quiet voice. "Slow and easy now. Don't cut corners, or that's where the rot will set in." She scrubbed the interior of the cabin, clearing out age-old spider's webs, the skeletons of small rodents, and clusters of fungi. She patched a couple of gaps in the wall forced open by creeper roots, and hired a local firm to empty the septic tank. They confirmed her water came from a well and advised her it couldn't be drunk because of rust in the supply pipes, but was perfectly good for washing. Every morning, she set herself tasks for the day. Replacing the window glass, scrubbing the ancient grime on the bathroom fittings, digging a fire pit for barbecues, reconstructing the swing seat. There was always more to do. She bought a camp bed, a little folding chair, and a cool box to keep insects out of her food supplies, but otherwise left the cabin unfurnished, apart from Dimitri's old desk, and the stove that looked nice but was too rusty to use for cooking. Her bags were piled in one corner of the spacious main room, and the only decoration was a bunch of wild flowers thrust in a plastic tumbler on the desk. She rather liked the minimalist look. At the end of each day, when she had achieved her goals, she had a long swim round the tip of her bay and into the next, to cool down and cleanse the dirt and sweat from her paws. Afterwards, she sat on the edge of the porch with a glass of wine, letting the breeze dry her hair, looking out over the lake, and planning what she would tackle tomorrow. Thoughts of Tom hovered in the periphery, but she kept them there. As an only child, she was good at managing without company, but it wasn't easy to forget a marriage. At some point, she would have to decide what to do. Later. For now, she was focused on making her cabin perfect. The surroundings were so stunning that she wanted to do them justice. She decided this would be her finest building project ever. Jeff at the vacation park proved very helpful, letting her drop in to recharge her power tools and advising on local suppliers. One day, when she stopped by, he handed her a parcel. The copy of Dmitri Yakovlevich's novel Interminable Love had arrived. Its old-fashioned cover with a pattern of bottle green, taupe and black swirls gave no clue as to the contents, and there was no description on the inside flaps of either the story or its author. She took it back to the cabin and sat in her little canvas chair by the water's edge, naked, because the heat of the day was stifling. She kept a big T-shirt nearby in case any ramblers appeared, but clothes seemed superfluous so far out in the wilderness. The story began with a young country boy called Mikhail, who sees a local girl, Valerina, falling off her bicycle and rushes to help. The grazes on her hands and knees are bleeding and obviously painful, but she bites her lip and blinks away the tears, and at that moment he finds himself starting to fall in love with her. The translation of the text was uneven, with some awkward phrasing, but Kitty was soon hooked as young Mikhail explored the sensations of love. He wished he could get inside Valerina's skin and experience her every thought and feeling, so that he would never say or do the wrong thing. He was tortured with jealousy when he saw her in conversation with anyone else. He felt as though he was losing his mind to some overpowering affliction that brought more pain than it did reward. Soon his devotion paid off, and she fell in love with him too, but he found it hard to believe. His emotions swung from exhilaration one moment to anxiety the next, and, without meaning to, Kitty found her thoughts wandering back to her early days with Tom. She had first spotted him playing his songs to a small group at the Students' Union, and she liked his absorption in the music, his unruly hair, the striped Pierrot T-shirt and braces he was wearing, and his grin when everyone applauded at the end. For a few weeks she stalked him, looking for a way to introduce herself. But in the end, he made the first move, appearing by her side when she was placing an order at the bar and saying cheekily, "Mine's half a bitter." "Can you add half a bitter?" Kitty asked the barman, and Tom was shamefaced. "I was joking. You don't have to buy me a drink. Let me give you the money." She insisted on paying, and he followed her over to join the group she was with, introducing himself around the table. He was affable, and everyone seemed to like him. But Kitty was so attracted to him at close range that she could barely focus on the conversation. She longed to place her hand on his thigh, nestle into his shoulder, press herself against him. She'd never felt such lust for anyone, and wondered how he could be oblivious to the sheer force of it. But it seemed he wasn't. At the end of the evening, as the others rose to leave, he took her hand and whispered, "Can I come back with you, please?" Kitty was staying in student accommodation, where they weren't supposed to have overnight guests, but she sneaked him in. As soon as the door closed behind them, they ripped off their clothes and spent the night in a frenzy of steamy, compulsive sex that left her head feeling as though it was stuffed with cotton wool. When she got up to make tea in the morning, Tom said, "This is a little awkward, but I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name." And they both collapsed in giggles. It still made her giggle now. and then she remembered Karen with the double R and stopped abruptly. She got up and laid the book to one side while she waded into the cool waters of the lake. It was shallow close to shore, but she always swam out until the cabin was barely distinguishable amongst the dense woods that surrounded it. From that distance, she could see how isolated it was, with no other man-made structure for at least a mile on either side. It was 3 weeks since she arrived at Lake Akanabi, and she hadn't been in touch with anyone back in England. She knew this might be construed as eccentric behaviour, but the solitude was feeding something within her. She could feel herself getting stronger with each day of self-sufficiency, and she supposed, before long, she would be tough enough to go home and deal with her marital problems. Perhaps she could also deal with her discontent about the whole fabric of her life. She was 35 years old, and it was time to decide how she wanted to spend the next few decades. If she wasn't going to be with Tom, she should look for someone else before the wrinkles and grey hairs set in. She shook her head to dispel this image. The thought of being with another man filled her with dismay. All that adjustment as you learn someone else's tastes, their sleeping habits, their moods. She dived down through the clear, cool water. She could see the bottom, but it was further than it looked, and she had to turn and come up for air before she reached it. The heat was too intense for hard physical work, so Kitty decided to take a day off and immerse herself in her great-grandfather's novel. It was strange to get a glimpse of his personality through the story, while living in his cabin and walking in his footsteps. She felt a kinship with him as she lay in the shade of the trees he must have looked up at and read Interminable Love, his first novel. Civil War separated Mikhail and Valerina when their families were sent to opposite sides of the country, and he was forced to fight, but their love remained strong as ever. Neither would marry, neither could contemplate being with anyone else, so they lived half lives, shadowed by the memory of their first and only love. As the sun set, Kitty lit a fire, cooked herself a burger on a rack set over the flames, opened some wine, and continued to read in the orange flickering glow. In the final chapter, Mikhail tracked down the remote Siberian village where Valerina now worked on a collective farm. He asked around, to be told she was out in the fields operating one of the newfangled tractors that had just been delivered. Modernity was often portrayed as evil in the novel, with machines taking the place of people, in a metaphor that suggested the unquestioning obedience to the regime of its cowed citizens. Mikhail spotted Valerina from afar and began to run towards her. She saw him approaching, realized who it was, and tried to turn off the tractor's engine. But something went wrong, and it started to accelerate. It was heading straight for Mikhail, so she pulled down hard on the steering wheel, and as the vehicle turned, it toppled onto its side, crushing her underneath. Mikhail struggled to lift the tractor, but it was far too heavy. He called for help, but there was no one in earshot. Valerina's injuries were too severe for her to survive, so he lay on the earth beside her, kissing her face as she slipped off into the blackness of death. It was something of a cliched ending, but tears were streaming down Kitty's cheeks. She wiped them on the hem of her t-shirt, but couldn't stop crying, and soon she was sobbing out loud, with huge painful spasms that hurt her chest. She hugged herself and buried her face in the crook of her elbow, crying with the abandon of a child. She hadn't even cried like this when her parents died. Was it because she was tipsy? What was this about? And as soon as she asked the question, she knew. It was because she missed Tom. There was so much she wanted to tell him. She wished he could see the work she had done on the cabin. She wanted to tell him about this Russian great-grandfather who had been an author. Perhaps he could help her to decide how to make her life more fulfilling. But he was not her Tom anymore. She couldn't talk to him because the huge matter of his infidelity lay between them, and until she could decide how to deal with that, it was easier not to be in touch at all. As she lay in bed that night, wrung out from crying, Kitty's thoughts turned again to Dmitri Yakovlevich. He must have been a romantic soul to write so movingly about love. Why had he been living in such a remote spot? Was he alone there? Did he ever come to London to meet his great-granddaughter, or was he too elderly and frail to travel by the time she was born? his bed had been in the spot where she now lay, in a corner beneath the window, so he must have looked out at the silver birch tree branches swaying in the moonlight, just as she was doing now. She didn't believe in ghosts, but at that moment she felt as if she could almost sense his presence, standing a few feet away, calmly watching over her. Next morning she drove to the coffee shop with her laptop and tried to find out more about Dimitri. She went to an ancestry website she had used for journalistic research at college. It had a US immigration section, but she couldn't find anyone with Dimitri's name. She tried her grandmother Marta's maiden name and the search engine Word, and finally came up with a child of 8 years old who had entered the United States in 1934. That sounded about right. Travelling with her, in a second-class cabin, were her mother, Rosa Lieberman, a name Kitty had never come across, and her brother, Nicholas, aged 9. She'd heard there had once been a great-uncle Nicholas, so this must be them. She looked further up the page, and there it was. Dimitri Yakovlevich Malama, aged 43 years and 4 months. Was his real surname Malama? Why had he used Yakovlevich on his novels? The party's place of departure was given as Berlin. It took Kitty only a few seconds to speculate that the reason for their departure from Germany in 1934 might lie in Rosa's Jewish-sounding surname. But how had Russian-born Dimitri come to be in Berlin in the first place? She tried several other searches, but with no more success. She couldn't find where Dimitri and Rosa had lived on arrival in the US, what schools the children had attended, or where he had worked. She closed the computer and drove to Indian Lake for some pots of varnish. She wanted to cover the entire cabin with a weatherproof coating while the weather was dry. The man in Lakeside Country Stores recommended the type he said was most effective against the cold, snowy winters in these parts. He was respectful now, as if he'd accepted she knew what she was talking about. While she worked on the front wall that afternoon, she heard an outboard motor on the lake and turned to see a mahogany-skinned, silver-haired fisherman close to the shore. She waved and walked down to the broken jetty to greet him.
"You're bought the cabin, have you?"
he called, squinting up at it. "I inherited it," she explained. "My great-grandfather used to live here."
"Well, I'll be," he exclaimed. "You're Dimitri's kin? I thought that cabin was a write-off, but he would be happy to see you doing it up all nice."
Kitty blinked. This man had known Dimitri. Rather than spend an hour on the internet, why had she not thought to ask around locally? "Can I offer you a beer or a coffee?" she asked.
"A beer'd be nice."
He tied his boat to one of the broken struts of jetty and leapt ashore.
"Name's Bob. I live on the far side," he gestured.
Kitty fetched two buds and a bottle opener, and they sat on the grass facing the water. He offered her a Marlborough and lit up himself when she refused. "It's funny you should come along, because I've been trying to find out about Dimitri," she began. "Were you two friends?" Bob shook his head.
"We said hi when we bumped into each other at the store, but he never invited me here and I never invited him to mine. We lived our own lives."
"Did his wife stay here with him?" Bob frowned.
"I never saw a woman, just him padding round on his own, with his dog at his heel. He was a writer, so I guess the solitude suited him."
"I read one of his books yesterday. Until recently, I had no idea we had a writer in the family."
"Yeah, I got all his books. He gave them to Sue and me as a wedding present. My wife likes reading, but I've no time for it."
"That's amazing." Kitty was delighted. "Have you still got them? Do you think Sue would mind lending them to me?"
"I'm sure she wouldn't mind."
He glanced over towards his home and chuckled.
"See that glen in the trees over yonder? It's probably her looking out for me with the binoculars. She'll be wondering what I'm doing drinking beer with a pearly lady."
Kitty saw a dancing point of light in the direction he indicated. She hadn't considered anyone might be watching through binoculars, and flushed to think they could have seen her wandering around naked.
"You're not lonely here?" Bob asked. "Is your boyfriend coming over?"
"My husband's back in England," she said. "I'm keeping myself busy, as you can see." She waved an arm at the half-finished coat of varnish.
"Let me give you my cell," Bob said.
He scribbled the number on the back of the foil in his cigarette pack with a pen from his shirt pocket.
"You call if you need anything. It's a remote spot for a young girl like you."
She was touched by his concern. She felt completely safe in the cabin, but it was good to have a neighbor's number in case of an emergency. When he left, he promised to return in a day or so with Dimitri's books. She went back to her varnishing, annoyed to see that the stretch she had already coated was now covered in dead and dying flies, like the bloody aftermath of some miniature battle.
Chapter 16. Moldavia, December 1916. By the time Dimitri arrived in Moldavia, a hilly country squeezed between the Russian Empire to the east and the Austrian Empire to the west, winter was closing in. There could be no fighting while mountain passes were closed due to thick snow and the ground was too hard to dig trenches, so all sides hunkered down. Dimitri was furious to find he had travelled hundreds of miles south simply to spend the next few months living on meagre rations in an army bunker when he could have been in Tsarsko Selo, close to his beloved wife. It was characteristic of the complete lack of foresight amongst the Russian high command. Looking back, his wedding seemed like a dream. He still could not believe that he was married to the most beautiful, most talented of the Romanov Grand Duchesses. Tatiana's letters came regularly, and there was a new air of intimacy about them. She confided in him about family matters that she would have considered disloyal to discuss before their marriage. "Olga finds it too hard to continue working in the hospital. She does not have the stomach for watching operations or cleaning wounds. Her nerves are suffering from the prolonged absence of our father and brother, and she has transferred all her attention to Mitya. Yes, he's here again. I swear she talks of nothing but him, and I am fed up hearing of his every word and breath. Meanwhile, she never asks about you, sweet Malama. I think she is jalouse of our closeness, and prefers not to hear of it." She wrote that Anastasia and Maria fought more than ever, sometimes wrestling on the floor, pulling each other's hair and having to be separated by force. She wrote that her mother was taking increasing doses of Veronol for her many ailments, which made her so sleepy that Tatiana invariably had to attend the tedious refugee committee meetings on her own. And always she wrote with concern for Dmitri's safety, begging him to keep warm and stay out of harm's way. While she was anxious about him, he was becoming increasingly alarmed about the safety of the Romanovs. Now he was back amongst soldiers, he realized many were saying openly that the royal family had to be overthrown. Nicholas no longer had the support of a large number of his men, who were fed up being sent on suicide missions against a better-equipped, better-managed opponent. The territorial gains made by General Brusilov's advance had already been reversed by the Austro-German Ninth Army, and there seemed little hope of victory on that front. Meanwhile, the letters the men received from their families back home told of dire food shortages and dread of the starvation winter would bring. Even the army survived on what they could hunt in lieu of regular rations. And now that Nicholas was at the front and Alexandra was in charge in St. Petersburg, there were louder rumblings that she was too much influenced in her decisions by Rasputin. "I reckon they are German spies who send Russian military secrets to the enemy. That explains why the Germans are always one step ahead," Dmitri heard a soldier telling his friends. He wished Alexandra had a wider circle of advisers, but she had always remained aloof from the St. Petersburg aristocracy and trusted no one except her husband and Rasputin, laying them open to all sorts of allegations. On the 18th of December, Malevich came to Dmitri's tent with alarming news from the city. Rasputin had disappeared, and foul play was suspected. Instantly, Dmitri was worried for Tatiana's sake, knowing how distressed she would be, and quickly sent off a letter expressing his sympathies. He had never met the man. An opportunity had not arisen for Tatiana to introduce them. Despite his instinctive mistrust, he understood how strongly the family felt they needed him, and knew the loss would hit them hard. The following day, a letter came by messenger from Tatiana, telling him the horrific news.
"Uncle Grigory has been murdered. Hideously murdered. And it seems it happened at the home of Prince Felix Yusupov, who is married to my cousin. I can hardly bear to write the words, but perhaps you know already, because it is all over the newspapers the men were reading in the hospital this morning. One of them even showed a gruesome photograph of his corpse with an eye gouged out. His poor eye. Dmitri, they say he was poisoned, stabbed, shot, and still he did not die until they drowned him in the Malaya Nevka River, where his body was discovered beneath the ice. What has happened to our country? Why would anyone do this to a holy man? I simply don't understand.
Dmitri guessed Yusupov might have done it in an attempt to protect the family from the insidious rumours about the holy man. If only it would stop the rot, it would be worthwhile. But he couldn't say this to Tatiana, so he sent back a note repeating how sorry he was, and how much he wished he could be there to comfort her in person. The following day another letter came, only slightly calmer than the last.
I am comforting myself by looking through a notebook I have kept over the years, in which I wrote down his wisest teachings. One day I will show it to you, Dmitri, so you understand his true goodness. Mama is inconsolable at the loss. She says Uncle Grigori is a martyr who deserves to be sanctified, and begged that he should have a state funeral. Papa, who has returned from the front, disagreed, and this morning he arranged a simple service at which we all paid our respects. Mama laid an icon on Uncle Grigori's chest before the coffin was sealed, and we dropped white flowers in his grave as we said our desolate farewells. I just don't understand a world in which such a thing can happen. I wish you could explain why.
Dmitri hoped word of this funeral did not become public. Tatiana had no idea about the mood of the populace, which turned uglier by the day. The common soldier was jubilant about Rasputin's murder, while in the streets of St. Petersburg he heard they lit candles in celebration and chanted, "A dog's death for a dog." Dmitri dreaded what this might portend for the royal family. If men dared to murder someone their sovereigns held dear, it meant that the last vestiges of respect for the monarchy were ebbing away. But if it was overthrown, what would take its place? A republic, as in France? What would that mean for the Russian people? Who would uphold the traditions of their great nation? And more urgently, what would happen to the Romanovs? If only Dmitri were close enough to protect his new wife. He felt impotent to be stuck hundreds of miles south. It was unbearable to think of her coming face to face with a stone-throwing mob, such as were said to be attacking public buildings in St. Petersburg. The Alexander Palace had no regiment to defend it, merely a few underqualified guards. Unable to contain his anxiety, he wrote an impassioned letter to Tsar Nicholas, saying that in such inflamed times there should be plenty of loyal retainers stationed in Tsarskoe Selo to watch over the Tsarina and the Grand Duchesses. The old imperial guardsmen with whom he had trained would have laid down their lives to protect the family, but they had all been sent to war, and the current royal escort was composed of raw recruits with less dedication and training. He begged Nicholas to recall him to the palace to do what he could to keep them safe. Dmitri did not expect his letter to have any effect. He had little faith in his Tsar's perspicacity. But perhaps the man had more of an inkling of the state of the nation than he revealed, because he replied by return that Dmitri should travel to Tsarskoe Selo post-haste to take a place in the royal escort. He added, "I know that you are a good and true friend to my family, and trust you will report to me directly any concerns you might have." Dmitri packed his kit and caught the first train for St. Petersburg, arriving on the 7th of January, the Russian Orthodox Christmas. He travelled on to the Alexander Palace at Tsarskoe Selo, and before even going to his quarters, he asked the butler to deliver a note requesting that Tatiana come down to the side entrance. He had been waiting just 10 minutes, shivering in the brutal cold, when Tatiana appeared in a thin gown. She gave a little cry when she saw him and hurled herself into his arms.
"For the rest of my life, no Christmas gift will ever mean as much as this."
Dmitri opened his coat and wrapped it tightly around them both, so their bodies were pressed together for warmth. He vowed, silently, that as long as he had breath in his lungs, he would not let anyone harm a hair on her head. If necessary, he would lay down his life to protect her. Chapter 17. Tsarskoe Selo, Russia, February 1917. Tsar Nicholas stayed in the Alexander Palace at Tsarskoe Selo for 2 months after the murder of Rasputin, making plans for a spring offensive against the Germans. The billiard room was covered in maps marked with a profusion of arrows, crosses, and scribbles, which he pored over night and day. Dmitri thought he was deluded to imagine he was capable of planning such a campaign. Did he have any idea that levels of desertion from the Russian army were rising daily, and that there was a growing threat of all-out mutiny? Like them, he had no faith in his Tsar's abilities as a commander, and wished he would hand over the reins to one of his experienced generals. Nicholas sometimes acknowledged him with a quick nod when they passed in a corridor, but never spoke to him, and Dmitri wasn't sure that he knew who he was. For 6 blissful weeks, he was able to see Tatiana every day. She was hard at work in the hospital, while he had many duties as a member of the royal escort. But they sought each other during breaks, when they would talk and play with Ortopo, just as in the old days. He teased her that her training of her pet had been so lax that when they went for walks, Ortopo chose the route. That when she threw a ball for her, she invariably ended up fetching it herself. Ortopo was the boss. In the evenings, he sometimes joined her in the wards to listen to a group of Romanian musicians who had been hired to play chamber music to the patients, and they sat close, not quite touching. Dmitri felt the air between them charged with the delicious secret that they were man and wife. He heard Volodya had been transferred elsewhere to convalesce and was relieved not to come face to face with his erstwhile rival. Tatiana had no inkling of life outside the palace, and Dmitri decided not to enlighten her. It would cause her distress to no purpose, because she could not solve the country's economic problems. For ordinary Russians, bread was scarce, meat unheard of, and prices in the few shops that still stocked food were sky-high. Her father had outlawed the production and sale of vodka at the outbreak of war, and men were brewing homemade versions that made them wild drunk and uncontrollable. Ugly mobs burnt pictures of her parents in the streets, and cartoons in the press showed the Tsar and Tsarina eating meals of caviar and lobster, or lighting cigarettes with 100-ruble notes while their people starved. Tatiana would have been baffled and greatly upset had she seen them. The mood of the public was the foremost worry preying on Dmitri's mind until in mid-February. Tatiana came to tell him that both Olga and Alexei had succumbed to fever and hacking coughs, and the doctor had diagnosed measles.
"Poor little Alexei,"
she sighed.
"He so wanted to return to Mogilev with Papa. I think the men there are very kind to him."
"You will stay away from the sick room, won't you?" Dmitri urged. "I don't want you to catch it."
"Mama is nursing them, as she has already had measles, and I don't think you can catch it twice. I have moved into Maria and Anastasia's room."
That evening, Dmitri thought Tatiana looked a little flushed as she went about her duties in the hospital. "Do wrap up warmly for your journey back to the palace," he cautioned. But it was too late. The following morning his fears were confirmed when her lady's maid, Trina, came to tell him Tatiana too had fallen ill. She sent a quick note, but her handwriting was scrawled and quite unlike its normal copperplate.
"I pray I have not passed the sickness to you, my darling. This really is the most horrid affliction. Forgive me that I do not feel sufficiently well to write more."
Dmitri sent her a note with an early snowdrop pressed between the pages, saying that he was sure she would still look dazzling, even when covered in spots. There was no reply, and within days Trina brought news that the illness had worsened. Tatiana developed abscesses in her ears that made her deaf, and the doctor was concerned her hearing might be permanently affected. It was agony for Dmitri to think of her suffering. If only it were possible, he would have taken the measles upon himself to spare her. He had already had a dose as a child and did not suffer too badly. Trina told him that Tatiana's beautiful auburn hair had been cut short to quell the fever, and he begged for a lock. When she brought one, he slipped it under his pillow, and every night he stroked the soft hair across his cheek, and in his head he whispered words of love to his secret wife. He pined for her. Dmitri's thoughts were focused on the invalids, but he heard rumblings from the town that thousands of women had taken to the streets to protest about the food shortages and that their numbers were being swollen by the hour. On the afternoon of the 25th of February, he heard the sound of gunfire outside the palace gates and gathered a handful of guards before running out to seek the cause of the commotion. Several hundred townspeople were protesting, many waving placards, and some of them armed.
"Pray, calm, I beg you,"
he shouted over the noise. The royal children are critically ill.
Let them rot in hell,
a woman yelled.
At least they're fed, unlike my children.